a preference group that's not viable is that if you want to challenge the political establishment and if you want to change business as usual politics, then come stand with us. Because I think people are fed up with business as usual
and
politics.
And is there a deadline? What time is it all expected to wrap up tonight, Hugh? Is it, what, 11 o'clock Eastern time, 10 o'clock Iowa time?
You know, it's not like a basketball game where you got, 20 minutes per half or that sort of stuff. I mean, it could go on. It all depends. I think it's going to be interesting. I think the Democratic caucus sites are going to last longer because of the preference groups. And there's going to be some questions about viability in some of those caucuses. So I would say, starts at 7. I think, we'll have a pretty good idea about 9 o'clock.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. We do have a deadline. Thanks, USB. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8 o'clock. Coming up next is more talk radio with hosts Celeste Carey and Cecil Prescott. Today's guest is Policy and Political Director at Peace Action, Paul Kawika Martin, here to talk about our recent deal with Iran and the potential for similar deals in Syria or North Korea.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the book release for Radical Mycology, a book on DIY mushroom cultivation, pollution cleanup, and more. The book release event will take place February 6th from 5:30 to 9 p.m. with author and Portland native Peter McCoy speaking at Tabor Space in Portland. McCoy will give two different presentations on the book's topics. There will also be a performance piece, projection art, and more. Again, that's the Radical Mycology book release, Saturday, February 6th, from 5:30 to 9 p.m. at Tabor Space, 5441 Southeast Belmont Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 33rd Real Music Film Festival running through February 8th. Tuesday, February 2nd will be They Will Have to Kill Us First. When jihadists took control of northern Mali in 2012, they imposed one of the strictest interpretations of Sharia law in history. Music was banned, radio stations were destroyed, instruments were burned, and musicians faced torture or even death. In a country celebrated for its vibrant musical tradition, the most revered members of society, musicians, were forced into hiding or exile. This film follows Mali's musicians as they fight to keep music alive in their country. That's February 2nd at 7 p.m. at the Northwest Film Center in the Witzel Auditorium at 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information on the films and more can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the first annual Portland Bob Marley Birthday Party, Saturday, February 6th, starting at 6:30 p.m. at the Melody Ballroom in Portland. The life of Bob Marley will be celebrated with live reggae by Simba Puma and the Roaring Lions, by DJs Reggae Bob and Pablo One from Kingston, Jamaica, and live streaming from Kingston's own Bob Marley Festival. Again, that's the first annual Portland Bob Marley Birthday Party, Saturday, February 6th, starting at 6:30 p.m. at the Melody Ballroom at 615 Southeast Alder Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Thank you. morning. You're listening to KBOO Community Radio, 104.3 in Corvallis, 91.9 in Hood River, and 90.7 in Portland. It is on the web, kboo.fm. This is More Talk Radio, and my name is Cecil Prescott. Today is February 1st, 2016. And today we are speaking about peace and war. As you just heard on Democracy Now! This evening, the first presidential caucus in Iowa will be taking place. And among the issues that voters will be concerned about this year are the perennial problems of war and peace. Joining us this morning is Paul Carica Martin, who is the political and communication director of Peace Action. And he will speak today about their work, and we want to encourage you to give us a call if you have questions or comments. And again, you may call us at any time during the radio program, hopefully before the end of the program. And our numbers here are 503-231-8187. Good morning, Mr. Martin. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me, Cecil.
Well, thank you for joining us. We wanted to begin our program by talking about the recent Iran deal, but also want to expand our conversation beyond that. Recently the nation ought to have celebrated the effectiveness of diplomacy. I have not heard too much about that in certain circles, in terms of certain political circles, but it's certainly something to be celebrated. And explain why this was an important deal and why it seems to be working, at least initially.
Certainly. Maybe we'll take a couple steps back and just remind what we're talking about.
Explain it, yes.
Sure. We don't want any countries to make new nuclear weapons or any new nuclear countries. That's kind of the consensus in the world. And most countries that have been getting them new have gotten them illegally. So if you look at like the last three countries, you have Pakistan and India, both of which got them through nuclear power and then illegally transferred some of that fissile material into making a nuclear weapons program. Israel did the same type of thing. So the international community has been concerned that perhaps Iran has had some sort of a program that it would want to make nuclear weapons, and it currently and certainly has had a program to make nuclear power. And unfortunately, making nuclear power and that technology is parallel to being able to make nuclear weapons. During the Bush administration, in fact, the Iranians and its current president, who was part of the Iranian government at the time, reached out to the Bush administration and said, let's talk and figure out how we can work on some of the issues that we have between the two countries, which includes a nuclear weapons program and other issues such as funding terrorism and other issues of concern with the Iran regime. Now, instead of negotiating with Iran, the Bush administration decided to add it to its axis of evil put more sanctions and pushed Iran away. So unfortunately, the technology that Iran was building for nuclear power continued to increase. Centrifuges are needed to make the fissile material that you could either do a nuclear power plant, or if you switch it up a bit, you can make nuclear weapons. And those centrifuges went to only a few thousand, very crude technology type of centrifuges, to very high level, and several thousand under the Bush administration. Now, the administration should get some credit, because at the very end of the administration, when the power of the Vice President Cheney has waned, and to be sure, Cheney actually wanted to move forward with military intervention into Iran. His power waned at the end of the administration, and Nick Burns of the Bush administration started secretly reaching out to to Iranians at the end of the Bush administration. And then when President Obama came into office, he's also opened up the doors to Iran. And it really wasn't until their presidential election, which elected Rouhani, who brought in a whole bunch of reformers, all of which have been supportive of re-engaging the West. It wasn't until that election that negotiations started, and then secretly, and then 2 years of negotiations through the international community, something called the P5+1, which is the permanent five UN Security Council members plus Germany, negotiated with Iran. Finally, in July of this year, worked out a deal which said if Iran takes the steps to block all pathways that you could possibly get used to get a nuclear weapon, and also subject itself to very intrusive inspections and monitoring by the International Atomic Energy Association, we will lift the very hardcore sanctions that have probably decreased its economy by 9% over the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. And that agreement happened in July, despite a lot of opposition, mostly by Republicans. And recently, a couple weeks ago, the implementation day occurred, and that meant that the IAEA has confirmed that Iran has taken all the steps that it agreed to in the agreement. And so this includes highly enriched uranium, which is a fissile material, that they yes. could only have a certain amount of it, and only at a certain level, which is would not make it usable for nuclear weapons. They also reduced the number of centrifuges it's had by two-thirds. So they cut the number of centrifuges they had by two-thirds. And the third they have left are the lower tech kind, so they could not be used for fissile materials. Iran was also building a plutonium using nuclear power plant, and the plutonium that would be left over could be used in fissile material. What they did with that is they actually took the core out, they shipped that to Russia, and they poured concrete where that core was. That reactor could never be used again in the future, so that's another pathway blocked. So those are the three main pathways that were blocked, and then most importantly, they have subjected themselves to monitor all these sites and very thorough inspections. And for that, monies have been released, sanctions have been released, about $100 billion. So all these steps were done through negotiations, through talks in the international community, and without firing a single weapon, we were able to get Iran to now not be able to have a nuclear weapon for at least 10 or 15 years, and moving from it could have broke out to try to build one if it so decided. Now, again, we don't know that Iran necessarily wants one. It could have broken out in a few months to try to build one. Now, if they wanted to do it, it would take them at least a year to get enough fissile material for a very crude nuclear weapon. And we would find that out and be able to take action. So it's a success on the international community's front and the Obama administration for diplomacy.
And this is, monumental. And as you just referred to, this is an international agreement. Yet there remained opposition during the negotiation, not only among Republicans, but certainly among some Democrats. And even after the agreement was made, there continued to be loud opposition. Do you want to comment about, for example, when the Prime Minister of Israel spoke before the Congress in opposition to this agreement, and, you know, the continued opposition up until fairly recently of many who opposed it. What was the nature of Israel's opposition? And I'll let you just comment on that.
Sure. Well, first of all, this is kind of a political dynamic. And the political dynamic is there's no politician who's ever lost an election for being too harsh on Iran. Mm-hmm. And so Iran has always been a good boogeyman, someone to demonize. Historically, we have done this, right? You know, if it wasn't Noriega, or if it wasn't Russia, or if it, you could pick whatever demonizing country you want to have. Politicians have always been able to get elected, raise money by saying that they're the strongest persons and they will take the harshest actions and we will do the meanest things to these evil people wherever they are. So there's that political dynamic. The second political dynamic is the Israeli lobby. And there is a very strong lobby that supports the government of Israel and is very could be very concerned on any possible threats to Israel in which some claimed Iran was a threat. And so those governments certainly had, I mean, the Israeli government certainly had used its U.S. connections to lobby against the deal, even though now the head of the Israeli military recently said that the deal has clearly made Israel safer. And there were a number of internal security analysis who said that that would make Israel safer. So the politics were such that demonizing Iran was a way for one, helps getting Israeli politicians elected. Two, it helps Israeli politicians and groups within the U.S. to raise money using Iran as a boogeyman, and we need to raise money so we can make sure we save Israel from Iran. And those are some of the political dynamics which then ensnare some U.S. politicians because the Israeli lobby has historically actually gotten people kicked out of office by not supporting them and supporting primaries, opponents, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And they've had a very strong political arm that they're willing to flex when necessary.
And as you just mentioned, certainly it is in Israeli interest for Iran not to have a nuclear weapon, and as the military leaders realize that this seems to be a good deal. We're speaking with Paul Kirica-Martin of Peace Action. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187. We're speaking about the Iran nuclear deal. We'll expand the conversation a little bit later on, talking about the Middle East, refugees issues, and the political dynamics within the United States. Let's go to our first caller, however. George, good morning.
Good morning. I have a question for your guest. I'm aware there are two books on depleted uranium issues, and although this may not seem to be part of War and Peace issues, to people in the Balkans where the depleted uranium was used, many people feel that the depleted uranium gave rise to some serious disease problems, and in Iraq also, and perhaps other places, that I would like to ask the guest if he has seen or read parts of the book Metal of Dishonor, How the Pentagon Radiates Soldiers and Civilians with DU Weapons, that's depleted uranium weapons, and that is a book published, I think, by the International Action Center. And there is another book which I stumbled on a few years ago, put out by the Japanese newspaper the Chugoku Shimbun. And it is called Discounted Casualties, and it's the results of a reporter team going from Japan to the United States and to Iraq and to England to interview some of the soldiers and some of the civilians who live nearby testing areas for depleted uranium. And so I would like to ask the guest if he is interested or if he is aware of these books. Has he read anything about any of these essays in these books?
Okay, thank you so much. Would you wish to comment, Paul?
Sure. Thanks for the question, George. It's very possible. I've seen some of the excerpts of the books. Peace Action has had a long standing opposition for, one, the use of depleted uranium, and also in support of a lot more research on the effects of the use, specifically on soldiers and civilians. So we have a position on that. We typically don't necessarily work on that issue very strongly, kind of leave that to some of the veterans groups and those who have more the expertise around medical effects of these weapons. But we certainly oppose the building of them, the using of them, and support more research into the effects that they're having on soldiers and civilians, and that, if necessary, extra steps and support for civilians and soldiers should be warranted.
Thank you, George. To get back to the Iranian nuclear deal, is there any need for any congressional action to take place? And what happens when we have a new president? Is there a possibility that the deal might fall through if there's a president who opposed it?
So certainly a new president could try to ratchet back the United States' action. So it could impose some new sanctions. That's pretty much the only leverage, you know, of course, besides some sort of crazy military intervention, which all high-level military leaders have said would at best, would only put Iran back a year or two, and at worst could start a whole World War III. So it would make no sense to have military intervention in Iran on the nuclear weapons issue. So the reason that the sanctions may have worked was they were internationally based. And so the U.S. on its own really does not have enough leverage to affect Iran. So it would not make any sense for a new president to try to take action, because just don't have enough leverage, and we're not going to get back the coalition, especially when we have Iran who's actually taken the actions that we've asked it to take. So it'd be very difficult to see a new president try to scuttle the deal, and a new president probably doesn't have enough power to completely scuttle the deal.
Is there? Do you foresee any possibility of opening diplomatic relations with Iran in the future?
Well, we already have in some ways. So there's already better communications between the two countries. That certainly can be seen with the prisoner swap that happened at the same time.
Yes.
Same time that the deal was implemented, and also with the sailors that were captured in Iranian waters. The dialogue happened very quickly between the two countries. Sailors were released within 24 hours. That kind of dialogue might not have happened under a different administration or a different, different time. So it's very hard to undo relationships that are forged after, 2 years of being either face-to-face or on the phone. And it's not just high-level relationships such as between Secretary Kerry and Secretary Zarif in Iran. It's also the mid-level and low-level connections of staff that get to talk back and forth and are on email, even may become friendly. It's those kind of relationships that keep incidences from escalating, which certainly could have happened when the Iranians took U.S. sailors prisoner when they were in Iranian waters, and it didn't. And I think that just shows that, it's open to more discussion. I'm sure there are already discussions that are happening that are not necessarily public. It's already been shown that the amount of monies that have been given to groups that we consider terrorist groups by Iran has lowered over the last year or two, and that's significant. Iran has also been more apt to work with us on the ISIS issue. It is in opposition to other things that we might support, such as some of the things that are going on in Syria. But now we have there's a conduit in which to have these discussions. And I assume that these discussions will continue this year, and depending on the next president, hopefully will continue afterwards.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio here in Portland. This is More Talk Radio. I am Cecil Prescott. We are speaking this morning with Paul Kricker Martin, Political and Communications Director of Peace Action. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187. We're speaking about the Iranian nuclear deal and other issues of war and peace. Let's go to our next caller. Barth. Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm happy to hear your guest speak about this subject. A couple of points. We have kind of a national myopia about the reasons that Iran is such a political problem for the United States, because we basically caused a coup, took away their democratically elected leadership in the not-so-distant past, and put them on the path that they've come on, and then keep poking them with a stick, as it were, and a big stick, threatening them in very fundamental ways. The objection on the top end that we keep hearing in the echo chamber of media is that Iran can't be trusted, that they have veto or delay power over the actual inspection process, and that there will still be nuclear weapons in Iran. It'll just take a little longer, and that is kind of the ultimate nightmare for the West. I'm not sure that that can't be overcome through negotiations, as your guest is filling us in on the details, but there are already nuclear weapons, in Israel, quite a lot of them, apparently, and that there are other equally scary and unstable forces in that region that have nuclear ambitions or capacity, as you mentioned, in Pakistan and India. I'd like your guest to talk about the objections that are coming out politically, mostly again from the Republicans, about the lack of free inspections or the ability for the Iranians to potentially obfuscate and delay actual on-site inspections, and that the objections about freeing up their funding, which was largely held in the U.S. Over a long time from the sanctions, that is now going to allow them to have financial and political clout further afield in the region. I'll take my answers off the air. Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much for raising those questions that we will continue to hear of those who oppose this this agreement. Mr. Martin.
Sure. Thanks a lot, Bob. I think it is important for us to look at some of this in a little long-term history, which Bob brings up, and I call these kind of things unintended consequences. And so, yes, it was the CIA in the late 50s that caused a coup in Iran, and things have gone downhill with our relationships with Iran since then. So there's, you never know who you support, what kind of unintended consequences you may have. This also happened, obviously, in Afghanistan, in which we supported the Mujahideen, which ended up turning into the Taliban. You can look at Iraq, which we made a vacuum, also created terrorism there. So there's unintended consequences when you take some of these military interventions, or you support one party over the other with military means, and it's very difficult sometimes to know how this stuff is going to play out over the long term. Now, a couple of the other things that Bob mentioned are inspections. So inspections, there's a long list of places where IAEA are either already have monitors, such as 24-hour cameras or people on the ground. There's a list of places where that's happening. The place where Iran could delay, let's say, some sort of inspections would be places that are not on the list and that are part of their some sort of a military site. And if they object, then there it goes to a vote, and the vote is the P5 plus one. And if the vote says we should move forward with it, then there should be inspectors on the ground within a week or two. Now, some critics say, well, by then they can move, whatever they need to move. But building nuclear weapons is a very difficult thing, and they usually leave some sort of a trace. It would be very, very difficult to have a very illicit nuclear weapons program and try to move it within a week or two without leaving some sort of a trace. And, you know, the cost of doing so, very difficult. So that inspection is most people in the nuclear weapons community think that these inspections are perfect and fine, and it would make very difficult for Iran to have an illicit nuclear weapons program. The last thing you kind of brought up was the funding. And again, most analysis right now say that Iran is going to use the money that's been freed to help its economy. Its reformers who are currently in power, these current reformers were brought in and elected because of some economic issues. Already you can see the first thing that President Rouhani did when the sanctions were released was take a trip to Europe. They have now have deals a mile long with all kinds of European countries, you know, including buying new jets. Peugeot has moved back in. I can go down the list of companies. So they're using these monies now to invest and kind of try to jumpstart their economy. Monies, as it stands, is not necessarily being used for terrorist activities.
You mentioned in terms of responding to possible objections, and I was wondering, and no one of us have crystal balls, but there's certainly objections, you know, for negotiation in the West, and I'm sure there are objections for negotiation within Iran itself, probably over issues, I suspect, of, you know, national integrity and national sovereignty. Are there any, are you aware of the opposition President Rouhani faces within his own country, and are there possibility that there might be barriers placed up from full implementation of the agreement from the Iranian side?
So just like the U.S., you can't paint the country as one big political blob. There are hardliners and reformers and people in between in Iran. As it stands, the person who really kind of holds the big strings is a supreme leader who has been supportive of Rouhani and his outreach to the West, specifically on this issue. There's certainly some hardliners that opposed, but they have not had enough power to move forward. But looking long-term in that country, as it stands, two-thirds of the country is actually under 30 years of age. It's a very young country, and you could probably remember it was only a few elections ago where you had the Green Movement, protests on the street during elections. That reform-mindedness, young people moving into power, that is happening now. So the country is moving away from the hardliners and moving more towards reformists. I've been lucky to actually visit the country over the last in 2006. I was there for a few weeks, and you'd be surprised. Like going into the normal middle class Iranian home, it looks like a middle class American home. They got MTV through the satellite. The kids are running around half naked. Just like, you know, kids run around here, it looks exactly the same. It has one of the highest levels of people getting nose jobs and plastic surgery. I mean, people just don't realize how embracing of Western culture that Iran is, and that is only moving further that direction and not farther. So I think people who think that there are concerns that Iran will then want to get a nuclear weapon in 10 or 15 years when the agreement has worn off, I think Iran's going to be a completely different country in 10 or 15 years. And still, we will have the monitoring and inspections, so we'll know if Iran does move such direction, but I'm doubtful that that's going to be the case.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio here in Portland, broadcasting out of Portland, Oregon. My name is Cecil Prescott. This is More Talk Radio. We're speaking with Paul Martin, the political and communications director of, I keep wanting to say, SANE, of Peace Action. And our numbers here are 503-231-8187. Give us a call if you have a question or comment.
That opens us up to just a quick history. So you were correct. So our peace action was formed some 60 years ago. It was called the Committee for a Sane Nuclear Policy at the time. And in the 80s, there was a movement called the Freeze Movement, which was a movement to freeze the number of nuclear weapons that were being built around the world during the Cold War. That grassroots movement called the Freeze Movement actually merged together with the more highbrow white paper writing SANE, and it was called SANE Freeze for a number of years, and now we're called Peace Action. And we've expanded from working, obviously, just on abolishing nuclear weapons, which is the issue we were founded upon, to other issues such as opposing most military intervention, reducing the Pentagon, and reducing the Pentagon budget.
Excellent. Thank you for that history. Talking about, you know, in terms of your origins, in terms of opposing the expansion of nuclear weapons, and one of our earlier callers talked about other countries who currently have or who are suspected of having nuclear weapons. Recently, North Korea has been in the news for they reported they tested a hydrogen bomb. I would like your thoughts on whether or not the nuclear deal with Iran, the negotiation, could be served as a model of negotiation with other nations. Are there any other current backdoor negotiations with North Korea? How might we include North Korea into these type of discussions?
Yeah, excellent question. So there had been six-party talks, which were most of the countries surrounding North Korea, South Korea, Japan, China, and then some westernized countries in the U.S., who were working together to try to bring North Korea into the fray and to make agreements with North Korea. And there had been a few which did work, where we provided food and humanitarian aid to a country which unfortunately has a lot of poverty and issues of starvation and stuff like that with its populace. And trying to support that in exchange for North Korea giving up some of its nuclear weapons technology. That had fallen apart a number of years ago, and it needs to start again. And one of the things that I think we can learn is there were no preconditions to the negotiations with Iran. There were a lot of people who said, okay, if we're going to talk to Iran, we should say they need to do this, that, or the other before you come to the negotiation table. And we all know that's just not how negotiations work. You cannot just say you have to agree to this, that, and the other, and then we'll have a discussion. You need to have a discussion, and then agreements come out of it. And that's one of the things I think we learned from the Iran agreement, and that's one of the things that we should move forward. And as it stands, all six parties are ready to kind of come back to negotiations. The only country that's holding it up is the U.S., who is trying to put some preconditions before the negotiations. So I certainly would put pressure on the Obama administration not to have preconditions so we can get back to negotiations with North Korea. I'm certainly not at a level to know right now if there are any two-track talks or backdoor diplomacy going on with North Korea. I wouldn't surprise me. That certainly has been the history. I think the other thing that we can learn from the Iran deal is not only were some of the large sanctions effective, but it was some of the targeted sanctions that were effective with Iran. We've now, with technology, we're able to target specific countries, even specific individuals, so we could put the hurt on the people who are actually making decisions rather than making broad-based economic sanctions where really just affects either the poor or just the common person of the country. So threatening I think having a dialogue with North Korea, making it clear that we're willing to have some more targeted sanctions, where we target some of their wealthy, some of their wealth accounts that they use to have fun with. Those type of things, I think, would be valuable in moving forward with North Korea. There are certainly a couple of other steps. I mean, this country still has yet to ratify the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. It's only a handful of countries who haven't. That step would help put pressure on North Korea, a little bit more support of the UN. The UN currently has a Comprehensive Test Ban organization, which is not a permanent organization yet because the treaty hasn't been ratified. That organization can be made permanent, so it would have a better budget, et cetera. I mean, it's that organization that's really we use to monitor these nuclear tests. They're the ones that have all the monitoring stations so that we're able to tell when tests happen and what kind of tests they were. And then, you know, you mentioned other countries, so we know that Israel does have a secret nuclear weapons program, probably has some 200 nuclear weapons. The UN was supposed to move forward with a talks for a Middle East free of weapons of mass destruction. Those talks continue to be postponed. We need to move forward to have those UN talks because that would help not only lessen tensions in the Middle East, but also show North Korea that that we will be taking action on countries who have nuclear weapons.
You're listening to More Talk Radio here on KBOO. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 is the Omo Variety Hour. Dave Finkel will discuss the origins of ISIS, the situation in Syria, and what diplomacy may or may not be able to do to end the fighting. Also in that program, a review of Tara Coughlin's The House Girl, a reading from a piece by Owen Hill that asks what winter would look like in a socialist society, and some seemingly long-dead labor history, the story of the loyal legions of loggers and lumbermen, newly resurrected in a historic site. Thanks, KBOO members, for your support, and please remember you can always become a member by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. You're listening to More Talk Radio. I'm Cecil Prescott, and our guest is Paul Carica Martin, Political and Communication Director of Peace Action. We focus on the Iran nuclear deal. We just finished speaking a little bit about North Korea. We would like your thoughts and comments. Our numbers are 503-231-8187. This is certainly the political season, and tonight the first caucuses will take place in Iowa. I would like you to help us to ask what type of questions we should be asking presidential candidates, and what are the issues that should be encouraged them to talk about?
Certainly. I mean, obviously, my organization is very focused on foreign policy issues, and there's certainly a number of important issues like climate change and economics and stuff, but we would focus on the foreign policy. And some of the questions we would like to hear is, you know, what's some of your long-term solutions in reducing terrorism? You know, most of the actions of the world tend to be focused on the military side of things, which actually doesn't necessarily solve terrorism in the long term. There are a number of things that people think will help reduce terrorism in the long term. That is poverty reduction, increased education, and one that people don't think about is something called the feeling of freedom. There's just a lot of young people who are, one, poor, possibly uneducated, and they feel like they have no other options, that they're not free to increase their lot in life, and then they're more apt to be recruited into terrorism. So there are a number of things that actions that can be taken to take care of terrorism. Also, we would ask about the Pentagon budget and how the candidates want to deal with the Pentagon budget. As it stands, our Pentagon budget is about the same as every other country's combined, and that just seems a little bit too high. It's more than half of our discretionary budget. And most people, if you ask them how they would spend their budget, would probably not spend 50% on alarms and fences and whatever to defend their house. That's just too much. And there are places that we could cut, one being nuclear weapons. We say that we want a world free of nuclear weapons. 95% of the nuclear weapons are held by the U.S. and Russia. And as it stands, we are planning to modernize our nuclear weapons program. We plan to modernize the missiles, the submarines, and the planes, as well as even make a new type of nuclear weapon called the long-range standoff missile, which would be a nuclear cruise missile. All these are exorbitant in cost. We're talking $1 trillion over the next 30 years. When we say we're trying to get a world free of nuclear weapons. So why are we spending these hard-earned tax dollars on weapons that only make us less safe than more? So those are some of the questions I think I would ask candidates to answer.
Listening to your response to that, it feels as if I'm living in two different universes. Listening to some of the presidential candidates, what I've heard is that we need to build up our military. I heard candidates talk about how our military is not as strong as it used to be, and we need to build it up. So how is it possible to talk to some of our fellow Americans and be able to get across that indeed, in fact, the Pentagon budget is very large, that it can be reduced, and we can reduce it, and we can be secure within our borders, and terrorism can be confronted?
Yeah, it's a continuing barrage of the facts. There's a great organization I happen to be on the board of, called the National Priorities Project, and their website is nationalpriorities.org. And on their site, you can actually compare, how much is your local community spending on, tanks and other military things compared to teachers, tanks versus teachers. And, what are these costs and what are the trade-offs? We know, just like your own budget at home, if you spend more money on one thing, that means you're spending less on something else. So what are we spending less on here in the U.S. to have such a high Pentagon budget? And so there's some of those trade-offs. And, what do they do for national security? There's been several military leaders who right now say that, there are two or three things they think are their top security threats to the U.S. One is a possible loose nuclear weapon or some sort of a nuclear disaster. Two is climate change, and three might be terrorism. So, are we really spending money to deal with these issues in the right proportions? And certainly at Peace Action, we argue we're not. We're spending too much on things like an F-35 fighter jet when there really hasn't been the need for a new fighter jet, and this thing is way over budget and costing gazillions of dollars and might not even work. And here we are spending, $1 billion a jet. When that money could be used better elsewhere. So I think facts are the key, and you can certainly look at some of these on our own website, peace-action.org, and also some great tools at the National Priorities Project, nationalpriorities.org.
Excellent. Those are some excellent resources that you've given us. A few minutes ago, you mentioned almost in passing that 95% of all nuclear weapons are owned by the U.S. and Russia. I'm wondering, and recently, again, I'm referring back to some of my observations of presidential candidates. There's it seems as if the Russia is now once again our enemy. I'm wondering what type of action is being taken or urged, or are there any negotiations taking place in terms of reducing nuclear weapons that the U.S. And Russia currently possess?
Well, when the relations between the two countries weren't so strained, the Obama administration did negotiate with Russia a new START treaty. And so that is the latest negotiations that took place. That's 2 or 3 years ago, which moved the U.S. down to about 1,500 strategic warheads. We still have several thousand in reserves, and similar steps taken on the Russian side. So some argue that the tensions are just too tight to have any kind of negotiations, and others argue, you know, one place where you could probably get agreement on something with Russia is on nuclear weapons. Russia really doesn't want to spend all this money on nuclear weapons. It's very expensive. It's costly. It's not necessarily the best way to spend your security dollar. And so that opening up negotiations with Russia, it might be a way, just like the Iran deal has been a way to have some discussions on other issues, might be a way to deal with some of the other issues that we're having with Russia. So I don't know, again, if there are any secret talks around these issues, but I would think that this would actually be perhaps something that we could reach out to Russia on and make an agreement, which may then open the door to discussing some of the other issues that we're having with the country.
And is your organization or other organization doing any sort of actions in terms of urging the two governments to continue negotiations? Is there a push for any particular treaty at this time?
We haven't specifically. One, we have no political power over Russia.
Right.
So we focus our issue, our pressure on the U.S. And so there's a couple of things that we are focused on over the next year. We do think that the administration can take its own actions specifically against this nuclear cruise missile, which we think is a waste of money. It's currently in the research phase. That's the time where you want to stop a new weapon, because once it gets passed and starts being built, it becomes more difficult. And we all know that none of these Pentagon projects ever come in budget. They're typically 1 to 2, 3 times more expensive than they say. So we'd like to try to nip that in the bud this year, and also focus on possible executive actions that the Obama administration might be able to take this year. So certainly negotiations with Russia is one of them. There's a number of high-level officials who say we can drop down to somewhere like 300 strategic warheads very easily. So maybe take one median step, which would be go down to 1,000, an executive order that would bring us down to 1,000 strategic warheads. And then we're trying to whittle down on this very large billions and billions of dollars in nuclear weapons budget that we feel like we don't need in the long term. So those are some of the areas of focus that we have over the next year, and it certainly does include negotiations with Russia if possible.
Excellent. We're speaking with Paul Karika Martin of Peace Action. Number 231. And we have David right now. Good morning, David. Thank you for waiting.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. You guys are touching on all the bases for getting the U.S. out of these foreign interventions. One thing you haven't mentioned, that there is one candidate out there who's right down your track on what you're talking about, getting out of these foreign interventions, negotiating with Iran, negotiating with Russia, and that's Rand Paul. And you know, he doesn't seem to get much play with the mainstream media echo chamber, but he certainly is a hope for Americans to get out of this this war stance we've been in for 5 decades or more since World War II. And he really does have an outlook of our economics, our health, everything in our country is suffering because all this money goes overseas into these wars. And, you know, if you spend some time listening to him, you'll really see that he's really the answer you guys are looking for in terms of a candidate that's going to get us out of that. And I'll just leave it at that. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you. Do you think, and certainly I know you cannot endorse any candidates, but are there candidates, are they addressing these issues that you're concerned about, that your organization is concerned about, and are you able to have any sort of conversation with candidates in terms of you know, the Obama administration is going to end in, what, 15 months or less than that? So what should we say to the candidates, Republicans, Democrats, and independent candidates that are out there?
Peace Action, we do have a PAC. Mm-hmm. We do endorse candidates. We do give money to candidates. We haven't endorsed in the presidential election for some 25 years. Though there may be an announcement about that in the near future. Okay. Certainly when I look at, on the presidential side of things, candidates, you know, as far as Republicans go, I would agree with David that Rand Paul on the foreign policy issues is more akin to us. He is anti-intervention for the most part, pro-diplomacy, and willing to take a hard look at the Pentagon budget. Those are all good issues. On the Democratic side of things, I think that Bernie Sanders is probably closest to our thing. He was opposed, people know, to actually both the Gulf War and the Iraq War. He's been very critical of the Pentagon budget, especially looking at waste and abuse on the Pentagon side, but also just its large budget. There is a piece of legislation in the Senate called the SANE Act, which was named after us, which would cut some $10 billion from nuclear weapons programs over, I actually cut about $1 trillion or something like that, of nuclear weapons programs over 10 years. Bernie Sanders is a co-sponsor of that. He was also opposing airstrikes in Syria. I can go down the list.
Yes.
And he does compare more favorably, I would say, than Clinton does. And then, you know, there's third-party candidates. The Green Party has been excellent on our issues for a number of years. They're just not, unfortunately not viable on the presidential level or on the federal level. Peace and Freedom Party, a couple of other third parties, but they're just unfortunately not viable candidates. So we do send out questionnaires to candidates, and we do give money and endorse candidates. We have you know, history of doing so, and there's a lot of peace what we'd call some of our peace champions who are in Congress now, Jim McGovern in Massachusetts, who's been the leader to get us out of Iraq and out of Afghanistan, Barbara Lee from California, Dennis Kucinich when he was there, and, you know, a couple in the Senate that we have give money to and help get elected.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us this morning, Paul Kirica-Martin, our Policy and Political Director of Peace Action. Their website is peace-action.org. And go there, get involved. And thank you, sir, for your good work.
Thanks for having me, Cecil. Very much appreciated.
And you've been listening to More Talk Radio here on KBOO. I'm Cecil Prescott. Join us next week, but stay tuned right now for the OMO Variety Hour. Hear more on war and peace and justice. Thank you. And thank you, Steve, for being our engineer. Have a great day. We'll be right back.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of When Money Talks, The High Price of Free Speech and the Selling of Democracy, a talk by author Derek Cressman on Friday, February 2nd, 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Cressman will discuss how courts have foiled attempts to limit campaign spending, what a constitutional amendment limiting paid speech could say, and much more. Again, that's When Money Talks, The High Price of Free Speech and the Selling of Democracy, a talk by author Derek Cressman on Friday, February 2nd, 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Community Acupuncture and Massage, a benefit for political prisoner Mutulu Shakur, Sunday, February the 7th, noon to 4 p.m. at 7 Star Acupuncture in Portland. Dr. Mutulu Shakur was one of the founders of the Black Acupuncture Advisory Association in North America and the Harlem Institute of Acupuncture. Incarcerated for 30 years, Mutulu and his legal team are seeking community and financial support to fight his imprisonment. A group of licensed acupuncturists and massage therapists are offering treatments to our community as a fundraiser. Again, that's of Community Acupuncture and Massage, a benefit for political prisoner Mutulu Shakur, Sunday, February the 7th, noon to 4 p.m. at 7 Star Acupuncture, 436 Southeast 12th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.